Hey, hello, Massimo Piglucci. Thank you for being here today with me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, I know people who follows me is going to know you already, but I would like you to give us a little bit of introduction about yourself, of who you are, the books you have written, and also the key moments in your life.
All right. Well, let's
That's a
try to keep
lot.
it short. So I'm a professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. And my background actually is in evolutionary biology. I was a scientist for about 25 years or so before I switched to philosophy. And my area of expertise is actually philosophy of science, that is the study of the nature of science. But I have also a very strong interest in practical ancient philosophy and in particular in Stoicism. I've written a number of books on both technical books, which are less interested to your listeners and to your followers, but a few for the general public, including How to Be a Stoic, that came out a few years ago, also in Spanish translation. And the latest one, which is A Field Guide to a Happy Life, which I don't think is out in Spain yet, but hopefully will be soon.
Yeah, we have Live Like a Stoic, which is
Right.
translated like something like a handbook for Stoics or something like
Yeah,
that. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
my handbook. And what are the key moments in your life? If you look back to your younger self, what are the key dots you like to connect that brings you where you are right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was never the plan to become a philosopher, and even less so to become, interested in Stoicism. The plan from very early on, from when I was a kid, was to become a scientist, which is what I pursued. College first, and then graduate school, and then the regular standard career for a university professor. And then at some point, I was going through a little bit of a midlife crisis, both in terms of my profession and in terms of sort of my personal life. In terms of profession, what happened was that, I was doing well in biology. My laboratory was funded regularly. I had graduate students, postdocs, and things like that. But at some point, I started thinking, see, yeah, but do I really want to do this for the next 20 or 30 years? It's like that seems like not very exciting. And so I was looking around for a different path, which is not unusual for academics in the middle of their career. What is unusual is the path that I ended up taking. Most of my colleagues will maybe go from evolutionary biology to molecular biology or something like that, but definitely not to philosophy. But the fact is, I did have an interest in philosophy since I was in high school because I studied philosophy for 3 years in high school. And something serendipitous happened. The University of Tennessee, where I was teaching at the time and doing research at the time, hired a brilliant young philosopher of science named Jonathan Kaplan. Turns out that Jonathan actually had done his dissertation at Stanford on topics that were very close to the ones that I was working on as a biologist, which had to do with gene environment interactions, so nature and nurture kind of issues. So he actually knew my work and he looked me up. We met, we became friends, we started collaborating on joint projects. And then one day I said, it'd be nice if I actually take a different path now and enroll in the philosophy program, and maybe you can be my advisor. And I remember that. So keep in mind that I was a full professor, with tenure, while Jonathan was a young assistant professor, before tenure. And so I said, maybe you can be my advisor. And he looked at me like said, how many glasses of wine did you have today? And I said, none, because I don't drink at lunch. So he took he warmed up to the idea, and that's what we did. I became his student basically, and 3 years later I defended my dissertation, which was published as a book called Making Sense of Evolution. That changed my career. So a few years later, I was able to sh shift full time to philosophy, as as a professor of philosophy, moving eventually to the City University here at in New York. Then, however, about the same time, this kind of midlife, more personal midlife crisis happened. So things like, that happened to a lot of people. I was going through a divorce, which I did not expect, so it was kind of a surprise. And my father died, and then I changed jobs because of my shift to philosophy. That meant moving 1,000 miles away, buying a new house, that sort of stuff. Now,
Too
any
many things.
psychologist, Yeah, exactly. Any psychologist would tell you that one of those things is pretty stressful in a given, in any given year. All of those happened to me within a matter of a few months. And so it's like, I wonder, the universe is trying to tell me something here. And so that kind of generated a little bit of a crisis. So I figured, okay, well, how do I deal with this kind of, you know, life, literally life-changing situations? And, you know, as people normally do, you reach to either your religion or your philosophy of life, whatever, whatever it happens to be. Well, in my case, the problem is I grew up Catholic because I grew up in Rome, in Italy. But I left the church when I was a teenager, so religion was not an option. And ever since I left the Catholic Church, I consider myself a secular humanist. And so I said, oh, okay, well, then let me turn to, you know, writings by secular humanists and see if there's anything that's going to be helpful in terms of a general compass, a framework for how to deal with adversity and situations like this. And turns out there was nothing. You know, secular humanism is a very good idea in general. I mean, you know, it's all about human rights and justice and things like that. It's like, yeah, fine, I agree. But that's not going to help be helpful if my father dies or my wife divorces me. So it's like, okay. But then I figured, well, I just got a PhD in philosophy, so surely I can turn to philosophy and you know, move on in some way. So I started very systematically looking at different philosophies of life. I started with Buddhism because several of my friends said, you know, you should look into Buddhism, and which I did. And Buddhism has a lot of interesting things to say about ethics and about how to live your life. However, the problem was twofold for me. On the one hand, the language was kind of alien to me, obviously, because I didn't grow up in that sort of culture. So it's like it didn't really resonate with me in a deep sense. I mean, I understood what I was reading, but it didn't really click. And also, I really couldn't accept the metaphysics. I mean, the you know, karma and reincarnation, all this. I said, no. I left the Catholic Church because of that stuff. So I'm not, or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go back to that. So, okay, Buddhism was out. Then I pretty quickly realized that the answer was going to come from virtue ethics, what the ancient Greeks and Romans called virtue ethics. Why? Mm-hmm. Well, because virtue ethics, the point of virtue ethics is to work on your character. Mm-hmm. To improve yourself, to become a better person. So I said, okay, that's easy. That's exactly what I need. So it's like, okay, where do I start? Now, during my PhD in philosophy, I did take a course in ancient philosophy. And so I said, okay, I know where to start. I'm going to start with Aristotle. And Aristotle has a lot of interesting things to say about virtue ethics, particularly in his, you know, most famous book in that area, which is the Nicomachean Ethics. The problem is that Aristotle also didn't really speak to me, because he says things like, so in order to live a good life, you need to, you know, improve your character, to be virtuous, you know, practice your character. It's like, okay, that sounds good. But also you need a little bit of education, a little bit of money, good health, good looks. It's like, whoa, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It doesn't seem like the kind of stuff that actually you would need for having a life worth living. So in other words, Aristotle was a little bit an aristocrat. You know, essentially, if you follow his approach, only a fairly small number of people is actually going to have what the Greeks called a eudaimonic life, right? A life worth living. And I said, but I know people, or at least I know of people, who are not handsome, who don't have money, who are not necessarily very, you know, healthier and stuff. And yet they live a life that is definitely worth living. I mean, think about Socrates. Socrates was poor and was ugly. So according to Aristotle, he should have had an awful life, but he clearly didn't. So it's like, okay, that's interesting. The next stop was Epicurus. And the reason for that is because a lot of secular humanists really are into Epicurus. And the reason for that is that Epicurus was, first of all, an atomist. So he believed that, you know, the world is made of atoms bumping into the void. That's kind of a pre-scientific materialist understanding of the world, but it goes well with modern science. So it's like, okay, that's that kind of metaphysics I can you know, deal with. Also, he has a lot of interesting things. So he was, for instance, very skeptical of anything to do with gods. He was not an atheist, but he said God just stays over there thinking his thoughts and like doesn't give a crap about human beings. So don't waste your time praying, you know, don't do anything like that. He was very critical of people who have, he said basically, you know, you shouldn't be afraid of death because there is no such thing as the afterlife, that, you know, when death comes, you're not gonna, you cease to exist. So there's, you're not gonna feel anything. So why be afraid? All these stories that you've heard from priests and poets are just to scare you and control you. So okay, that sounds good. And also what I liked about Epicureanism was the emphasis on friendship as a major source of meaning in life. So all of that is good. Problem is, according to the Epicureans, the major goal in life is to live a life without pain, especially emotional pain, right? Now that sounds good. Unfortunately, Epicurus pointed out that one of the major sources of pain in life is social and political involvement. So he says, stay away from politics, stay away from social involvement, you know, just live in your little garden with your friends and don't bother with the rest of the world. It's like, no, I can't do that. That doesn't seem like a good life. Yeah. You know, human beings are inherently social and political animals. There, Aristotle was actually right, I think, on that count. So that's so much for Epicurus. Okay, now I'm left with, you know, I know the ballpark. It's got to be, the answer has got to come from virtue ethics, but I don't know where exactly. And so one day I see, I was checking my Twitter feed and I saw this thing that said, help us celebrate Stoic Week. I said, huh. I wonder what Stoic Week is, and also why would anybody celebrate the Stoics? Because I thought, mistakenly as it turns out, but at the time I thought that, you know, Stoicism is about the stiff upper lip and you know, suppressing emotions.
Cold person.
You know,
kind of,
going through life like Mr. Spock from Star Trek, and it's like, why would anybody want to do that? Despite the fact that Mr. Spock is actually one of my favorite characters on Star Trek. But it's like, no, that's not, I don't want to live that kind of life. But then I realized, like, wait a minute, hold on here. Because Stoicism is in fact itself a type of virtue ethics. And also I remember it's like, wait a minute, Stoicism, that's Marcus Aurelius, you know, the Roman emperor philosopher. And I read Marcus Aurelius' Meditations when I was in college and I found it an interesting book. And then I thought, huh, Stoicism, that's also Seneca. And I actually translated Seneca from Latin when I was in high school, and I thought it was interesting as well, you know, interesting writer. But somehow I never put the two together. I never actually understood when I was younger that Seneca was talking about the same kind of stuff that Marcus Aurelius was talking about. And certainly I had no notion that there was such a philosophy, you know, a elaborate philosophy of life that behind their writings. So I said, okay, that sounds interesting. So I signed up for Stoic Week. And so the first thing I did, I downloaded some materials to learn more about Stoicism, and I started reading. And the first guy that I read about was Epictetus. And, you know, he was a slave in the early part of the second century and, you know, actually late part of the first century. And he was brought as a slave to Rome, and then he was freed. Then he studied philosophy with Musonius Rufus, one of the major Stoics at the time. And then he studied speaking, as we would say today, truth to power. In other words, criticizing the emperor Domitian. He was sent into exile as a result of that, moved to Nicopolis in northwestern Greece. He reestablished his school that became the most famous school of ancient times, you know, in that period. One of the later emperors, Adrian, visited on a regular basis. Like, wow, this guy, it's incredible. And then I started reading Epictetus, and right at the beginning of the discourse, near the beginning of the discourses, I encountered this thing. It says, so one of these days we have to die, but it looks like it's not going to be today. On the other hand, I'm kind of hungry right now, so let's go have lunch. And I said, wait, what? Who is this guy? So here we have a guy who is straightforward. It just speaks like a regular human being. No convoluted phrases, no nothing. It's like very, very plainly understandable. Sense of humor bordering on sarcasm, which I kind of liked. You know, straightforward talk. And I said, and I never heard of this guy. Even though I have a PhD in philosophy, I never heard of Epictetus. How is this possible? So then, of course, I did some research. It turns out that Epictetus was actually a household name throughout the Middle Ages, because he's Enchiridion, his Manual for a Good Life, was actually translated in Latin and used by Christian monks as a set of exercises for spiritual growth. It was very famous during the Renaissance. You know, there was a first Italian translation by Poliziano in the 1400s. Even in, as recent as the 19th century, it was famous. I mean, several of the American founding fathers, including George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson, all had personal copies of Epictetus' works. It's like, say, so then something happened in the 20th century, like with when philosophy turned much more sort of abstract and analytical and academic and specialized, kind of Epictetus and in fact the Stoics in general kind of felt in the you know, out of view. So they're kind of in an eclipse. But in fact, Epictetus had been a major philosopher throughout, you know, almost two millennia. So it spoke to me, it clicked. And I, at the end of the week, I said, okay, I'm gonna keep practicing Stoicism for another few months because Stoic Week usually is in October. So you know, I committed to do it until the end of the year. And then the following year, I said, okay, I'm gonna do the whole year of practice and studying. And then after that, I just continued. And so now here we are several years later talking about it, you know?
It's funny because you discover Stoicism with Twitter. And I discovered Stoicism through YouTube, which is kind of, it's funny.
Yeah, social media, who knew? Sometimes social media actually do something good.
Sometimes can change your life. So,
that's right. Yeah.
I have seen a lot of similarities between Stoicism and Buddhism, which is curious because they were far away in the physical distance from each other. Why is that? I have heard you talk about it several times.
Well, there are several reasons probably for it. So first of all, there are similarities not only between Stoicism and Buddhism, but also I found out later between Stoicism, obviously, and other Greek and Roman philosophies. Clearly, there is a lot of similarities. For instance, between Stoicism and Epicureanism, even though they're different, but there is a lot they have a lot in common. But there's also similarities between Stoicism and other Eastern traditions, including Confucianism and Taoism. I suspect that some of these similarities are the result of people thinking about the same kinds of problems and arriving at similar solutions, right? It's like two engineers on different sides of the world that have the same problem, you know, how do I build a fast vehicle for roads? And they come up with very similar solutions. So it's kind of convergent thinking. Some of these, on the other hand, are actually the result of, you know, cultural cross-fertilization. I mean, we know that obviously within the Hellenistic philosophies, you know, the Stoics knew about the Epicureans and vice versa. In fact, we know that they talked and debated for literally centuries. There's also been some contact between the Greeks and the early Indian philosophers. So one of the Greek philosophers, Pyrrhus, the skeptic, actually went to India for several years following Alexander the Great, who you know, went into India for his military conquests. And we know that Pyrrhus actually learned the language and talked to some of the early Buddhist monks. And so it's not surprising, therefore, that there might be some cross-fertilization. Now, Pyrrhus was a skeptic, not a Stoic, but when he came back, skepticism also influenced you know, later Hellenistic philosophies such as Stoicism. So some of those similarities may be the result of actual cross-fertilization, but I think it's a combination of those two things. And frankly, I'm more interested in the similarities that are likely the result of convergent thinking than cross-fertilization, because cross-fertilization is interesting, but it's kind of a historical accident. It might have happened or might not have happened. But if people in different cultures and different times arrive at similar ways of living a good human life, then that actually makes you more confident than that they hit something that works, that they hit something that has value. Yeah.
And also because they have survived the time. It's like they survived 2000 years or so.
Yeah, I know. People often say, so why would you follow a philosophy that was started, you know, 23 centuries ago? And my answer is like, well, because if they got something right, I don't see why I should reinvent the wheel 23 centuries later. Also, it's kind of a funny question because there are literally billions of people in the world who follow religions that started between 2 and 2.5 millennia ago, right? There's lots of Christians, lots of Buddhists, lots of Confucian. Like, well, Confucian is not really a religion. But, you know, so that nobody's asking a Christian, well, why are you following this guy that lived 2,000 years ago? Well, I'm following the guy because he said some interesting, important things, and pretty much nobody's done better since. So You know, yeah, of course you follow. That doesn't mean you buy everything that the Stoics said. Just like, you know, you don't buy everything that the Judeo-Christian traditions. I mean, no modern Christian, even fundamentalist modern Christians, are not Christians in the same way in which people were Christian 2,000 years ago. Because the society is different, because we reinterpret the New Testament and also the Old Testament in different ways, you know, and because there is a scholarship of theologians and, you know, different interpretations and even innovations later on. So nobody is a Christian in the same way in which they were in the beginning. So similarly, nobody is a Stoic today, or very few people are Stoic today, the same way in which people were Stoic, you know, at the time of Zeno, Citium.
Yeah. I agree. One of the similarities between Stoicism and Buddhism is they talk about the attention, focus, like prosoke, I think it's in English,
yes.
Prosoke,
yeah.
And also the Buddhist mindfulness. Is there any difference between the Stoic mindfulness and the Buddhist mindfulness?
Yeah, there are some interesting differences. So prosoke is the Greek word that often gets translated in English as Stoic mindfulness, although the most accurate translation is attention, as in paying attention to things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is more than one sense in which of the word mindfulness, even within Buddhism. You know, early or ancient Buddhism has one set of practices that fall into the general category of mindfulness. Westernized Buddhism has a different kind of set of practices. So there's no such thing as mindfulness, period. You always have to be specific about, you know, which tradition you're talking about. However, the major difference between Buddhist mindfulness and Stoic mindfulness is that in the case of Buddhism, you are either supposed to be non-judgmental about your thoughts, so you're paying attention, you're looking at your thoughts as they arise. That's the westernized tradition, but without being judgmental, without actually making any judgment. Or in the early Buddhist tradition from the East, you're paying attention to your thoughts and you are being judgmental about those thoughts, but in a very different sense than the Stoics. What the Stoics want to do, for instance, in ancient Buddhism, you pay attention not only to your thoughts, but also to the state of your body, you know, to your breathing, you know, things like that. Stoics are not interested in breathing. They're not interested in, you know, anything that has to do with the body, really. What we want to do, and also it's not a type of meditation. Mindfulness is something you're supposed to be doing, not at certain particular times of the day, like in the Buddhist tradition. You're supposed to be doing it literally every minute you're awake. Okay. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be mindful every minute of your life. And that is why it's the word prosoke is often better translated as paying attention. Basically, what the Stoics are saying is we need to pay attention to life as it's happening right here, right now. Why? And so not be distracted by thoughts about the past, for instance, or not being distracted by thoughts about the future. Why is that? Well, because the past is not under your control. It's gone. There's mm-hmm. nothing you can do about it. Right? The future is not here yet, and it's also not under your control. So where your agency lies is in what you're doing right here, right now, right? I'm talking to you right here, right now. So all my attention, according to Epictetus, ought to be focused on what I'm doing now, looking in you, talking to you in the best way possible. Why is that? Well, because nothing, as Epictetus says, nothing has ever been improved by not paying attention, right? So if I were all of a sudden, instead of, you know, I'm talking to you and then I also pick up my phone and, you know, I check my messages and things like that, right? Well, it looks like I'm multitasking, but in fact, what I'm doing is I'm switching very quickly between two different tasks, the result of which is that I'm doing both of them badly. I'm not talking to you in my best possible way because I'm distracted by the phone, and I'm not paying attention to my messages in the best possible way because I'm talking to you. So I should put down the damn phone and talking just to you, right?
Exactly.
Now, in the case of the Stoics, in particular, this is true in anything you do, but it's in particular true if what you're doing has moral value, ethical value. So for instance, if I'm dealing, you know, I'm a professor, university professor, so I deal with my students on a regular basis, right? So in dealing with my students, dealing with other people in general is an ethical action, or an action that has ethical balance for the Stoics, because you want to treat other human beings with fairness, you know, with dignity, et cetera, et cetera. So you don't want to berate them. You don't want to get angry at them and things like that, right? Well, sometimes one is tempted to get angry with his students, right? It's like, oh, come on, really? Did you do that? Did you not do that? You know, that sort of stuff. What the hell is wrong with you? You know, that sort of stuff. But I pay attention. I practice prosoke. And so when I talk to my students, even though they might have done something that was, you know, really not good, and you know, they didn't do their homework, they come up with excuses for that, they have no make no sense, et cetera, et cetera. I try to be mindful, to pay attention to what's going on, to be respectful and say, look, this is not the way to do things. Here's what you want to do to improve it, but not to berate them, not to getting upset, not to getting angry, and so on and so forth. So that is Stoic mindfulness. Okay. It's paying attention to what you're doing right here, right now, because nothing has ever been improved by not paying attention to it.
Okay, that's very good. I remember I watched a conference you did for a Spanish newspaper at País, I think. And at the beginning of that conference, you said the Stoics try to eliminate negative emotions, to focus on the good ones. Yeah. But we have told by psychologists and that we, instead of trying to eliminate negative emotions, we should try to manage them and to understand them. What's your opinion on this? Is the best way to do, or I am misunderstanding something?
That might have been actually an issue with the translation of the interview. I don't think I said eliminate, because as you said, you just say, psychologists are correct. You don't eliminate emotions. You don't suppress emotions, right? Emotions are there. You have to deal with them. However, so the Stoics say that we should do two things. We should manage the unhealthy emotions, and I'll give you an example in a minute. And then we should mindfully embrace and cultivate the healthy emotions. So an example of an unhealthy emotion is anger. For the Stoics, you never want to get angry or to act on the basis of anger. The reason for that is because even though anger might be justified, like you may be angry because somebody did something bad to you, or you might be angry at an injustice that you've seen, you know, something like that. So you may be justified in your anger, but anger gets in the way of thinking rationally about situations. It overcomes reason. And so the notion is you never want to act on the basis of anger. You want to calm down first, think about the situation, and then decide on a course of action, right? So Seneca, for instance, wrote an entire book on anger. And I think the modern psychologists actually would agree with much of what is in that book. I mean, after all, they do talk about anger management, right? Even though some psychologists say that that a little bit of anger is actually healthy, and the Stoics would say, no, it's never healthy. But in fact, in practice, I don't think that modern psychology differs that much from ancient Stoicism, because even modern psychologists would say, well, maybe sometimes anger is justified and it's even healthy, but you definitely don't want to act on the basis of anger. You don't want to act when you're angry. And that's what Seneca says. Mm-hmm. So Seneca says you cannot eliminate anger. You cannot suppress anger. The only thing you can do is to wait it out. Right. And then he says that there are some techniques that you can employ in order to help anger go away. So when you feel your first movement of anger, when you feel like your blood is boiling, you're getting, right? Don't do anything. Just get the hell out of the way, right? So go somewhere else. Go out for a walk. Count until 20. Take some deep breath. Anything that distracts you and leads the anger to subside, right? Only after the anger has subsided, then you come back to it and say, okay, wait a minute, let me understand here. Why was I getting angry? Oh, there is a problem. What is the problem? Oh, there is an injustice that's been done. Okay, well, what can you do about to rectify the situation? How can you act rationally in order to rectify the situation? So that's the way the Stoics deal with unhealthy emotions. A healthy emotion is, for instance, love. The quintessential healthy emotion is love. However, we have to understand what love means for a Stoic. It doesn't mean the romantic love falling, you know, heads over heel for somebody, because that actually is irrational. The Stoics would say, stay away from that, because that actually gets in the way of your reason. Again, it's not something you can suppress. And, you know, when you fall in love, you fall in love. There is nothing really you can do about it. And of course, as we all know, it is a pleasant situation, right? It's like being euphoric or drunk or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the Stoics are not saying don't do it, because that's impossible. There's no way you can avoid it. But they say don't act on it. Don't do stupid things, right? Don't do things while you are in that sort of situation. For the same reason that they say, you know, drinking wine is fine. The Stoics are often accused of, you know, not cultivating pleasures, you know, not appreciating pleasures of life. That's not true. I mean, Seneca clearly says, sure, if you want to drink, drink. No, not a question. However, try not to get drunk. And if you are drunk, absolutely do not make decisions while you are in that condition, because your rationality has gone out the window temporarily, right? Mm-hmm. So, but there are also a healthy versions of love. So when you're, for instance, you know, in a love for your friends, love for your children, love for your partner, once that the initial, you know, crazy part has subsided, you know, we all calm down basically, and we develop a deeper connection with other people, right? So, you know, being in love with my wife, for instance, now doesn't mean that, you know, that I'm crazy and that I feel that, like, the palpitations like when we met, right? But it does mean something actually deeper. It's more of an attachment. It's more of a caring thing. And so that kind of love, according to the Stoics, is in agreement with reason, as they would say. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's a good thing to do, right? Okay. And so it needs to be cultivated. It needs to be actually encouraged, right? So that's the idea, that you want to move away, you manage as much as you can the negative emotions, the unhealthy emotions, which are defined as any emotion that gets in the way of reason. And you want to cultivate, by contrast, the positive or healthy emotions, which are defined as those emotions that are in agreement with reason, that is reasonable to do. You know, it's reasonable to be loving for toward your children, for instance. Okay. It's reasonable to be faithful to your friends. That those are things that you want, because they're good things, right? We should also point out that, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, you want to do everything with reason. You know, what about the emotions? Like, the Stoics in that agreed actually with modern cognitive science. There is no sharp separation between emotions and reason. You know, this notion that there's reason over here and then emotions over there, and the two are kind of in conflict or something like that, that's actually a view that goes back to Plato and then has been rejected by modern cognitive science. Modern cognitive science will tell you that, you know, you only got one mind. You don't have bits and pieces that are doing different things. It's true that there are certain anatomical features, you know, areas of your brain that are more connected with the emotional responses and others with, rational responses. For instance, the amygdala at the base of your brain is where your emotional responses begin. That's where your adrenaline, for instance, and other hormones are, you know, start out. And it's true that your neocortex, which is the most recent part of the human brain, that's the part that is in charge of your, you know, rational decision making. However, it's also true, and, you know, any basic look at the brain anatomy will confirm that those two areas are massively interconnected. So it's not like there is emotion over here and reason over there, and, you know, they don't talk to each other. No, they are massively interconnected, so that your actual behaviors, mm-hmm, are always an inextricable combination of emotional responses and rationality. And so what the Stoics are saying is, you simply therefore act in order to, you know, decrease the responses that are not good for you and increase the responses that are good for you.
That's very good practice. It's like a speaking with them, right? Like speaking with your emotions, trying
yeah,
to
yeah,
to put
right.
Words.
Exactly, you dialogue with your emotions, right? So
yeah.
So Epictetus famously says, when you have an impression, which is your first reaction about certain things, right? Instead of acting on it, you know, hold on for a second, you hold your emotion at a distance and say, hey, wait a minute, you are just an impression. Maybe you're not what you look like. So let me talk to you. Exactly. It's what modern psychologists call cognitive distancing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So put some cognitive distance between you and your initial emotional response and see if your initial emotional response is important because it tells you something. When you get angry or when you get the butterflies to the stomach because you're, you know, emotion, there is an emotional response that's caused by a particular person you're with or something like that is telling you something. It's telling you that maybe you should be afraid of this situation, or maybe you know, this is a pleasurable situation. This is a good thing. The point is, however, never trust your first response. Just inquire into your, and let me give you a funny example actually of this.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's this woman, I read this really interesting article about this woman who was on a date one day. And, you know, they were at a bar and, you know, with this guy and the date was going okay. She was not thrilled by the guy, but she was not turned off either. So it's like, well, okay, nothing special, but, you know, fine. We're having a nice conversation. We're in a drink. And then at some point she felt like butterflies at the stomach. She felt like, you know, this kind of, you know, funny feeling. And she thought, oh my gosh, I've had this feeling when things were going really well, when things clicked. So maybe I'm just underestimating this guy. Maybe there is something that my stomach is telling me that I'm not actually perceiving, you know, yet. And so maybe I should pay more attention. And then she bolted, went to the bathroom and vomited. The butterflies were the result of a food poisoning, right? So she misinterpreted her own physiological reaction. She thought that, oh, the butterflies, oh, maybe this guy is interesting. It turns out it was food poisoning, right? That's what Epictetus says. It's like, slow down. Because you might actually, yes, you do have the butterflies, and maybe they're telling you something important. Maybe you should be listened to. But hold on a second. You know, before you decide to go and sleep with the guy at the end of the evening because you got the butterflies, make sure you actually have food poisoning, because that's another possibility, right?
It's amazing. It's a very good example, actually.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's a great story. Yeah.
Just talking more deeply about Stoic practices, I listened to you in another podcast saying something like premeditatio malorum is not the same exactly or like negative visualization.
And I
always thought it was the same. Can you explain us what's the difference between...
Yeah, so negative visualization is actually a modern technique that comes out of cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So authors like Don Robertson, for instance, who is both a Stoic practitioner and a cognitive behavioral therapist, will tell you to do the premeditatio malorum as a negative visualization. And so what you do is you get into a quiet situation in your home and you close your eyes and you try to visualize, you know, as if you were in a movie, a situation in detail, a situation that might be worrisome. For instance, let's say you have a job interview tomorrow morning. You close and you're worried about it. So you close your eyes, you imagine yourself dressing up for the interview, going to the interview, being at the interview, et cetera, right? So, and the idea there, which again comes from cognitive behavioral therapy, is that you familiarize yourself. You're basically running a simulation in your own mind of the situation. You familiarize yourself with the situation and you think about the worst possible outcome first. It's like, which in this case would be, I'm not getting the job, right? And then you work your way back and you say, okay, well, if I didn't, that's the worst thing that can happen, that I'm not going to get the job. Well, that's not the end of the world, right? And so you prepare yourself not only for the actual situation by sort of simulating in your mind, but also for a negative outcome so that you're not, you know, you're not freaking out, you're not overreacting and things like that. That's great. But that is one way to do the premeditatio malorum, which you definitely don't find in the ancient texts or whatever. Because they didn't have the concept of a visualization, you know, exercise. That's a modern thing. And if it works for you that way, that's great. Absolutely. Go on and do it that way. It doesn't work for me, for instance, because I'm not good at visualizing things. So not everyone is good at visualizing things. I am much more of a writing person. I need to write things down. And so the way I do the premeditatio malorum is the way in which Marcus Aurelius did it, writing in my journal. Mm-hmm. So the meditations was his personal philosophical journal. So when I want to do a premeditatio malorum, I actually start writing. I sit down in front of my computer and I say, okay, so tomorrow morning, you're going to go for the job interview. Well, think about what it's going to happen and what are the possible outcomes and how you're going to react to the possible outcome, that sort of stuff. And the goal is the same, is to understand that, you know, even the possible, the worst possible outcome is actually not the end of your life. You know, other people, you remind yourself of things like Marcus did. You remind yourself as like, okay, well, in the great scheme of things, this is nothing. You're so worried about something is going to happen tomorrow. But, you know, remember, you are just a speck of dust on a tiny little planet in the middle of a galaxy. You know, this is just one moment in time. Billions of years have come before you and billions of years will come after you. So like, you know, put things in perspective. Sure, it's important for you because you want the job, but you know, in the big scheme of things, it's not that important. You also remind, I think actually a more efficacious technique that also Marcus uses is to remind yourself that other people have gone through that and they coped, right? So for my psychology, from the way in which my psychology works, the view, what it's called the view from above, so I remind you of, you know, the immensity of time and the immensity of space. Yeah, sure, that kind of works, but up to a point. I mean, I still have to have the job interview. Yeah. and so, you know, galaxies or no galaxies, billions of years or no billions of years, I still have to have the job interview. However, reminding myself, as Marcus does, that plenty of other people have gone through similar situations. Plenty of other people did not get a job, and yet plenty of other people somehow coped with it and survived. And so who am I? What kind of schmuck am I that I cannot survive or I cannot cope with, you know, not getting a job? Of course mm-hmm. I can survive. Of course I'll be fine. And so that kind of helps, right? And that is a type of premeditatio malorum. So there are different ways of doing it. The visualization approach is only one of them. And it comes from the modern tradition in cognitive behavioral therapy, which is fine. I mean, I don't have a problem with updating Stoic techniques to the 21st century. Obviously, I mean, one of the books you mentioned earlier that did get translated in Spanish is my handbook for New Stoics, which is co-authored with my friend Greg Lopez. Mm-hmm. And Greg and I there put forth 52 different exercises for Stoic practice. And those exercises, they are based on ancient texts. If you look at the book, every exercise starts with a quote from Epictetus or Seneca or Marcus Aurelius or one of those. But it's also true, if you pay attention in, you know, if you read the actual chapter, that the way in which we present the exercise to a modern audience is actually updated on the basis of modern science. You know, there's a bunch of footnotes that say, and you know, modern psychological literature suggests that you do this or says that this thing works this way. So there's nothing wrong. In fact, it really should be done to update Stoicism with modern techniques. But sometimes these modern techniques work and sometimes I just prefer to go back to the original. And you know, in my case, as I said, visualization doesn't work, but writing does.
So Marco Aurelius is doing this premeditatio malorum when he says something like, every day when you wake up, remember, you are going to see an ungrateful, yes, selfish person, but he's, yes, okay.
Exactly. Okay. Right. And so, you know, this is the kind of stuff that you can do even today. You know, I can say, all right, today I have a meeting with the administration at the university. And, you know, you've been to these meetings before. You know that they're boring. You know that people talk a lot of nonsense. You know that, you know, they probably will upset you because they're going to say something that doesn't make any sense. Fine. Well, you have to do it anyway. So prepare yourself mentally. It's like, okay, I know I have to do this. And guess what? It's only going to last an hour. It's going to be over soon. And you know what expects you. You're not going to be surprised. You're not going to go in a meeting and say, oh my gosh, I didn't expect these people to say a bunch of nonsense. Of course you did, because you've done these meetings before. So fine. You know, just trying to minimize the damage. Basically, the premeditatio malorum is an idea of getting ready mentally for things that you cannot avoid, and therefore minimizing the damage. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Obviously, there are some really serious permutatio malorum. For instance, the most important, arguably, that I ever did in my life was when I knew that my mother was going to die. Right. That's a pretty big deal, right? Losing your parents is a pretty big deal. But when she got sick and she got diagnosed with cancer, I knew as a biologist, especially, I knew exactly what that meant. I knew that she had only a few weeks to go. And so I had to prepare myself mentally. It's not, it wasn't going to be useful to say, oh, maybe it's not going to happen, or it's going to last years, not weeks or months. I knew it was going to be short, and I knew that she was going to go. And so thinking about it in those terms helped me accept what was happening. And once you accept what's happening, then you actually can act accordingly, right? So you can actually focus on spending time with her before she's gone, so that you don't regret it later. Talk about things maybe you wanted to talk about for a long time and you have postponed, or do things for her that you wanted to do for a long time and postponed, that sort of stuff. So it's not, stoicism is not about miracles. It cannot tell you, oh, your mother is not going to die. But it does prepare you mentally to accept what's going to happen if it is inevitable, and to do your best in response to what is happening when it is inevitable.
And you said before, you don't buy some things from stoicism. What you don't buy from stoicism? It's not for everyone, right?
No, stoicism is not for everyone. So the ancient Stoics would have told you that stoicism is the way to live a good life. And of course, the Epicureans thought the same about Epicureanism, and the Buddhists think about the same about Buddhism, and so on and so forth. As a modern Stoic, I would say Stoicism is a way to live a good life, but not the way, right? So there are many different ways of living a life worth living. Mm-hmm. I chose Stoicism because it spoke to me, it clicked with me. I like the authors and what they're saying. The practice goes well with my personality and my situation in life, et cetera, et cetera. But I can see how it might not work for somebody else, and somebody else might say, Buddhism works better for me, or Confucianism works better for me, or Epicureanism. Fine. That doesn't mean that every life philosophy is good. I think there are some that are not good. I should not mention examples, maybe. But, I don't know. Let's pick one, I suppose. In my mind, at least, if you are a follower of objectivism, that's Ayn Rand's philosophy, I mean, that's a mistake. I think that's a pernicious philosophy of life. And if people are interested in why, I have 5 essays written on this thing that explain why I think that. I think that's not a good philosophy of life. It's too self-centered. It's not good for a human being to follow that philosophy. So I'm not suggesting that every philosophy of life is just as good as every other philosophy of life. Mm-hmm. I think some are good, some are not so good. Some work for some people, some work for other people. Now, you also asked, are there things that I don't accept about early Stoicism, ancient Stoicism? Yes, of course. For the same reason, again, that modern Christians not necessarily buy everything in the Old Testament, right? No modern Christian is going to go and stone to death their children because they lied to them. But that is literally what you're supposed to do if you follow to the letter the Old Testament, right? But nobody does that. Because I think, we today think that's ridiculous. I'm not going to do it, right? So there are certain things that you reject of a tradition. And in fact, one of the advantages of Stoicism is that the ancient Stoics themselves clearly were doing that and told us to do that. If you read Diogenes Laertius, he tells you about the disagreements between Zeno, the founder of the school, and Cleanthes, the second head of the Stoa. And then he told you about the disagreements between Cleanthes and Chrysippus, the third head of the Stoa. Mm-hmm. And then between the disagreements between Posidonius, a middle Stoic, and the early Stoic. So the Stoics themselves have often kind of reworked their philosophy and updated it, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's this beautiful passage in Seneca. In one of the letters to Lucilius, he says, look, of course I'm going to follow the ancient way if it is still good. But if I find another shortcut, if I find another way, a better way to do things, I'm going to do that one instead. Because, he says, Seneca says, those who preceded us are our teachers, not our masters. Right? So I'm not going to do something just because Epictetus says it. Epictetus is not God. You know, one of the advantages of a philosophy as opposed to religion is that I can disagree with Epictetus. Christians have a little bit of a hard time disagreeing with Jesus because Jesus alone is God. So it's like, you know, who are you to argue with Jesus? But who am I to argue with Epictetus? Well, I'm a thinking human being. And so was Epictetus. And so as much as I have respect for Epictetus, I think he got a few things wrong, right? The major thing that I think the ancient Stoics got wrong is their conception of the universe as a living organism endowed with reason, the famous logos. So the ancient Stoics thought that the universe itself, which they referred to as God, was living, a living organism, right? And but today science doesn't go that way, right? If you accept modern physics and modern biology, they tell you that the universe is a set of dynamic processes that follows certain regularities, which we call laws of nature. But no, the universe is not a living organism, right? So I reject that aspect of Stoic metaphysics. There are consequences, however. You can't just take out certain things and then say, oh yeah, the rest is fine. Because the Stoic system is a system. Everything is interconnected with everything else. And so if you reject something, then you have to be careful, think very carefully about, well, what am I going to replace it with? Because that has consequences. For instance, in the case of the cosmos as a living organism, one of the most important consequence that the Stoics derive from that is their notion of providence. Because the cosmos is a living organism and we are literally bits and pieces of that living organism, right? Then everything that happens to us is for the benefit of the cosmos. So Epictetus presents this metaphor, which is really nice. He says, imagine you are a foot that is part of a body, right? But you're just a foot. And you're not the whole thing. You're just the foot. And then all of a sudden, you have to step into the mud. And you're going to say to yourself, well, that's disgusting. I don't want to step into the mud. That's horrible. Why would I do that? But then you realize that you're part of a body. You know, it's not just the foot. You're part of a body. The body has to get home. And in order to get home, it has to go through a muddy, you know, street. And so you not only you step in because it's your duty at that point, because you're the foot, but you actually do it gladly. You embrace this notion. And the reason for that is because even though it may be unpleasant for you, you're actually doing something that helps the entire organism, right? That's where the Stoics, the ancient Stoics, get the notion of amor fati, love your fate. They didn't use that phrase. This is a much later phrase by Nietzsche, but they did agree with the sentiment. So Epictetus says, you shouldn't just do things, endure things and do them because it's your duty. You really should be happy about it. You should really embrace it, right? So one of your loved ones dies, for instance, you know, your daughter dies, you should be happy. And the reason you should be happy, it's not because it's not hard on you. Of course it is, right? It's your daughter. But you know that somehow that's helpful to the cosmic organism, right? What is happening here is actually helpful to the cosmic organism, and that makes you feel like, okay, this is something that I need to embrace. It's a beautiful.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, if you do away with the cosmic living organism, that notion of providence goes away, and so goes amor fati. You cannot love your fate. Sometimes things in life really do suck. If your daughter dies, that's not good. So what do you replace it with? Well, you look at the rest of Stoic metaphysics. The rest of Stoic metaphysics is still actually current because the Stoics believed in universal cause and effect. You know, everything is caused by other things. So there's a universal web of cause and effect. That holds. That's modern science agrees. Yes, there is the universe is regulated by cause and effect. They were materialists. They thought that everything that exists is made of stuff. And that too holds with modern science. Yes, modern science is a materialistic science. Of course, stuff is whatever physicists say it is, but nevertheless, we're made of stuff. They also believed in, they were sort of compatibilists about free will. In other words, they thought that we are responsible for our actions, but not in the sense that our actions are independent of cause and effect. They are also caused and they also have effects because they are actions that are made by, you know, implemented by beings that are made of matter and therefore have causal powers. So mm-hmm. all of that states, all of that is still valid. So what I suggest in the most recent book, A Field Guide to a Happy Life, which is in part is a homage to Epictetus because it's basically a rewriting of the Enchiridion, you know, section by section, you know, the 53 sections of the Enchiridion. But at the same time, it's also an update of the Enchiridion. It's an update of Stoicism to the 21st century. And so what mm-hmm. I suggest is like, you know, modern Stoicism cannot afford amor fati. It cannot afford, you know, this notion that was so beautiful but doesn't work anymore. So what are we left with? Well, we're still left with acceptance and endurance because we're still in part of a universe that is regulated by cause and effect. And so if my daughter dies, you know, God forbid, Zeus forbid, as the Stoics would say, if my daughter should die, that is obviously a horrible tragedy, but it's unavoidable. I mean, my daughter is a mortal just like anybody else. At some point she will die. Hopefully I will die before she does, but it could happen the other way around. And if that happens, I just need to be ready to accept it. Mourn her, absolutely, but at the same time also move on in my life because, you know, it's not the end of life. It's the end of one life, but it's not the end of life in general, right? So endurance and acceptance, I think, are still very much modern Stoic values, but loving your fate is something that we cannot afford.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think when your daughter dies, it has happened, so you have to deal with this, but you can choose the attitude you are going to deal with that, right? So you can exactly. choose not to be happy, but not to to punish yourself too much, but correct. you cannot love it, right?
Correct. You can choose what your attitude, you can work at least on what your attitude is going to be. And Seneca writes beautifully about these kind of things. He wrote three letters of consolation. One to his friend Marcia, who had lost, in fact, an adult son, and one to his mother, Helvia, because Seneca was in exile and Helvia was distraught by the fact that her son was in exile. And the third one to his friend Polybius, who had lost a brother. And in all of these, especially the one to Marcia, he says, of course, you're going to be feeling grief. That's human. Again, this is another one of those cases where, yeah, of course you're going to feel the emotion. This is like you wouldn't be a human being if you didn't feel grief, or you'd be a sociopath mm-hmm. if you didn't feel, you know, grief for your loved ones dying. But then he goes on and says, right, but now you have a choice of how to think about this. You can indulge in your grief and, you know, let it become self-destructive and, you know, completely hamper your ability to live a life, or you can say, look, this is something that happened. I have to deal with it. I can focus on the good moments that I had with this person. I could focus on the fact that I was lucky enough that this person was in my life for a certain period of time. And I can also focus on the other people that are part of my life. Seneca also wrote a letter of consolation to his friend Lucilius because a common friend that they both had died. And Seneca said, you know, one of the things you can do other than think about, you know, the good times you had with this person, is you can also focus on your other friends. You know, don't let your grief make you become a person who doesn't have friends anymore, right? You have other people to turn to, and you need to redirect your positive energies toward your other loved ones, because that's life. This is how it works, right? So grief is okay. It's natural. You certainly don't want to suppress it because it's not possible, but you want to slowly redirect your thoughts in more positive directions, in more productive directions in terms of your life, in terms of the people who love you.
So just to be finishing this interview, I receive a lot of questions about Stoicism for kids. I think it's complicated because it talks a lot about death and pain and adversity. Yeah. So should we Stoicism teach to kids, or it's complicated, or we should wait to be adults to learn about Stoicism?
No, I think we should start with kids as soon as they reach the so-called age of reason, which is between 7 and 8 or 9 years old. Before that, kids are not capable of abstract thinking. They're not capable of complex thoughts. And so it's not useful to do it before that stage. But as soon as they reach that stage in their developmental psychology, then I think that they should be exposed to philosophy, and they should be exposed particularly to Stoicism. In fact, I'm working right now with Greg Lopez and our friend Meredith on a book of Stoicism for kids. In our case, we're aiming at an audience between teenagers, kind of, so a little later. But no, I think it's important because, of course, it has to be done with the proper audience in mind, right? I mean, it just in the same way as there are science books for kids that are not the same as science books for adults, right? Because it's a different audience, you have different background knowledge, different abilities to understand things, so you write appropriately for the age. But I think kids should be introduced to philosophy. They should be introduced to Stoicism. And frankly, they should be introduced to this notion that they're going to die. Because, especially in American society, but increasingly or even in European society, we kind of want to put away thoughts about death as much as possible. And you don't want to deal with that with people who are dying. We put them away in a house, in a home somewhere else. We don't want to talk about it. We don't. Like, why? That is a natural process. It happens. It's the natural end of everybody's life. We all have to get to that point, and so you better be prepared when that happens, right? You don't want to be caught sort of unprepared and say, "Oh my gosh!" And it could happen at any time. We all think that, oh, it's going to happen way down the road, but we don't really know. It could happen today. I hope not, but it could happen today. So that's why Seneca says, study a lot of studying philosophy, or the point of studying philosophy is to prepare yourself for the ultimate test of character, which is your own mortality, your own death.
What advice would give you if you were 10 years younger? What advice would give you yourself?
That's a good question. I would tell myself when I was younger, you read Seneca and Marcus Aurelius, but you really didn't pay attention to what they were saying. So go back and and because there's some important lessons there to be learned, and they're going to be useful for you over the next several years. Don't wait until you get into your 40s or your 50s. They're going to be useful right now.
Okay, yeah, that's a good one. A good one. Who would like you? Who would like to see in the podcast? Who would you like to for me to interview about the stoicism or philosophy of life?
That's a good question. So on philosophy of life in general, I think my friend and colleague Skye Cleary would be a good one. She's not she's not a Stoic practitioner. She actually is interested in existential philosophy, but she co-edited a book with me called How to Live a Good Life, which is kind of a overview of different philosophies of life, including Stoicism, but also Confucianism, Taoism, Christianity, et cetera, et cetera. So she's really be a good guest to have and talk about philosophy of life in general. About Stoicism in particular, of course, there's lots of people that you could talk to. I would say I'm partial to my friend Greg Lopez, who is the co-author of the Handbook for New Stoics, because he's very much into the practice. He's very much, really sort of, okay, let's sit down here and do the stuff, not just talk about it. And so
I like that.
his emphasis is definitely on the practice. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So where can we find you if we want to know more about Massimo Pigliucci? Where should we go?
Well, people can follow me on Twitter at M. Pigliucci, MPIGLIUCCI. Or there is a website that's simply called massimopigliucci.com. It's one word, Massimo Pigliucci, my first name, my last name.com. And there you'll find pretty much everything that I write. I mean, there are links to all my podcasts, all my articles, books, and pretty much everything.
Perfect. I will link that to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the interview. It's been amazing. It's been very easy with you. So thank you so much for that. I appreciate that.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.